Hey, this is David Leffler, the host of Fumed, the podcast about two stubborn Texans fighting the petrochemical industry's takeover of their community outside Houston. We're working on some bonus episodes to update you on Carolyn Stone, Greg Moss, and the other Channelview, Texas residents you met on Fumed. But first, here's another story you need to hear from Jim Morris, the founder and executive director of Public Health Watch. It's about Dr. Peter Infante, a scientist Jim has known since the late 1990s, a man who spent much of his government career uncovering the dangers of benzene and other poisons that people routinely breathe in Channelview. Peter wasn't always popular with his bosses. Chemical manufacturers and oil refiners fought him at every turn. But his studies made American workplaces safer, and he almost certainly saved lives. We're bringing you Peter's story now because outspoken scientists like him are increasingly hard to find in Washington. Many have been purged or have left on their own as the Trump administration moves to tear down the federal government's health and science infrastructure. It's easy to take people like Peter for granted. People who toil behind the scenes for our collective benefit. We don't miss them until they're gone. This is The Scientist Who Refused to be Intimidated, a bonus episode of Fumed. Here's Jim.
On a muggy August afternoon in 2023, I rang the doorbell at a colonial-style house in Falls Church, Virginia, not far from Washington, D.C. The man who answered the door didn't look all that different from the brilliant scientist I'd met a quarter century earlier. He still had most of his hair, though it had turned white, and he still held a quaint notion that's unthinkable and perhaps even prosecutable in these fraught times. He still believes the public is entitled to full disclosure when it comes to chemicals that can kill people. I'd originally planned to talk to Peter Infante about his groundbreaking work on benzene. It's a widely used chemical that's been proven to cause cancer. I'd hoped his findings would be useful to people in Channelview, who've been breathing high levels of benzene for two decades. But after Donald Trump was elected president, this bonus episode became something else entirely. It became a profile of a public servant who took on corporate America and his own bosses to spread the word about urgent health hazards. Imagine how long such a person would survive in Washington today.
There's always a battle between public health and the entities that have money in the country. They never want to relinquish any of their money to make things better or to clean up the messes unless they're forced to do so.
Peter had a knack for spotting toxic threats long before other scientists did. You might even call him a seer. I met him in 1998 when I was working at the Houston Chronicle. I was investigating how the chemical industry had concealed the cancer risks people faced when they worked with vinyl chloride. It's a sweet-smelling substance that's used to make polyvinyl chloride, or PVC, plastic. You've probably got PVC in your pipes, your garden hose, your shower curtain. At the time, Peter led the Office of Standards Review at the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA. He was unusually candid for a government employee, a little cranky as if he were tired of all the crap he'd endured over the years.
Maybe I shouldn't say this, but I had one tie, had black and white diamonds on it, a wide tie. I only wore that on days when I knew that I was going to have to meet with people I didn't care to meet with. I'd make sure I wore my black and white tie because I thought it was so disgusting.
Kind of psychological warfare.
I'll show you.
Peter began studying vinyl chloride in the mid-1970s when he worked for the Ohio Department of Health. Scientists already knew that the chemical caused an unusual type of cancer, angiosarcoma of the liver. It was showing up in alarming numbers among workers in the PVC industry. Now Peter's boss wanted him to investigate whether vinyl chloride might also be causing problems beyond the factory fence. Peter focused on three Ohio communities that had vinyl chloride manufacturing plants.
What I found was that the mothers that lived in the areas with the polymerization facilities had a significant increase in their risk of birth defects. I particularly pointed out two severe birth defects of the central nervous system called anencephaly. Most of these children die before they're born because their brain isn't fully developed. And the other one was spina bifida, where they have this bifurcated spine and they have trouble surviving also.
Peter took a lot of heat for his birth defects investigation, and not just from industry. He also heard from officials at what was then called the Center for Disease Control, or CDC. Someone from the CDC called him in Ohio. It was the first skirmish in what would be a career-long war with industry, and sometimes his own government.
I get a call from Center for Disease Control, the head of their birth defects monitoring program. He seemed a little bit uneasy on the phone with me, and he asked me if I would not release the results till the director of CDC got back into the country. He was out, I don't know, abroad somewhere. So I thought about it, and I thought, well, wait a minute. I thought, I did this study for the state health department. I felt I had an obligation to the citizens of the state. So I did. I released the study results. There were some people that were very unhappy about it.
Peter presented his findings at a meeting of the New York Academy of Sciences. That's where he caught the eye of a division chief with the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, or NIOSH, another part of the CDC. NIOSH hired Peter in June 1975. A few months after he started his new job, the CDC published its own birth defect study. It found nothing of concern. Peter considered it a flawed attempt to contradict his work, which was gaining international recognition. Peter's birth defects paper was published in the Annals of the New York Academy of Sciences, and he spoke at scientific meetings in Europe and Mexico. He was satisfied that he'd helped alert the world to the hazards of living in industrialized places. But Peter had marked himself as a man who wasn't easily intimidated. It was a trait that would come in handy later in his career. At NIOSH, Peter began looking into benzene, a colorless liquid with an odor that's oddly pleasant. Benzene was discovered in 1825, and its dangers have been known since the late 19th century. That's when 9 young Swedish women developed aplastic anemia, a bone marrow disease. They'd been exposed to benzene while making bicycle tires. Benzene turned out to be a highly effective solvent, and its use grew, even as reports linked it to leukemia, lymphoma, and other cancers of the blood-forming organs. By the late 20th century, it was widely used in paint strippers and rubber cement. Not that long ago, workers used benzene to remove grease from their tools and hands. Some likely died as a result. But regulation was slow to come. Today, benzene is used mostly to make other chemicals that go into products like rubber, plastics, and insulation. Traces are also found in gasoline. When benzene is released into the air, it's an environmental menace. A recent independent analysis found that the cancer risk from benzene in Channelview could be up to 2,000 times higher than what the Environmental Protection Agency has estimated. I was curious to know what made Peter the way he is, why resisting powerful forces seemed to be in his DNA. His early life offered some clues. Peter is the youngest of 5 children. He grew up in Lima, Ohio, where his father was an office worker, mainly at Westinghouse, a consumer appliance and electronics conglomerate. His mother kept the books for her parents' grocery store. Peter's upbringing in a large Italian family in a small Midwestern town shaped his strong sense of right and wrong and turned him into the agitator he became.
My father was the choir director at the church. I'd go with my dad to choir. Every Thursday night was choir rehearsal with the church, and nobody's in the church but the choir. So I can remember, like, walking in the church down below. All the lights were out except for the choir loft and except for candles up near the altar. And I can remember hearing the echoing of my footsteps, and I could smell still incense and candle wax. And it was just a feeling like, you know, if I've ever felt like the presence of God, it was that time in my life.
When Peter was in grade school, his father was forced into early retirement at Westinghouse. It left a deep impression on him, showing him at a young age how easily American workers could be discarded.
I just felt so badly for him at the time. And I think he just always felt like he was inadequate in some aspects of being a husband because he lost his job.
After high school, Peter attended St. Joseph's College, a small Catholic school in rural Indiana. Then he studied dentistry at Ohio State. But an encounter with twin sisters during his residency changed his career plans.
One morning, they wheel this little girl in. Maybe she was 9 or 10 years old. She's in a wheelchair, and she's strapped into the wheelchair with a sheet. The only reflex she had was a sucking reflex, and she sucked on the hand part where the thumb comes out of your hand, and there was exposed bone because she had sucked on it so much. And at the same time, her twin sister is there. The twin sister was this, like, beautiful little 10-year-old girl.
The girls, it turned out, had grown up in inner-city Columbus. The one in the wheelchair? She'd eaten lead paint that had peeled off the walls of her home, profoundly damaging her brain.
I thought, wow, what a life was lost. And, you know, maybe I need to try to do something about that. And then that's when I became interested in disease etiology.
In 1973, Peter earned his doctorate in public health at the University of Michigan. His first job was with the World Health Organization in rural Guatemala.
Well, I wanted to care for people. You know, there are a lot of children with these various difficult health conditions that I was seeing every day. And I thought, you know, it's good that there are treatments for it, but wouldn't it be good if we could prevent that from happening so we didn't have to treat it? So that's been my whole thing as a doctor of public health.
At NIOSH, Peter began looking at death rates among workers at two Goodyear tire and rubber plants in Ohio. They were using benzene to make a food wrap called Pliofilm. What he found was shocking. The Pliofilm workers had a 5- to 10-fold elevated risk of leukemia.
We published the findings. The risks were so overwhelming that we thought we can't wait. We needed to inform the public.
That study was published in 1977 in The Lancet, a prestigious medical journal. It prompted OSHA to issue an emergency standard for benzene. OSHA reduced the workplace exposure limit from 10 parts of benzene per million parts of air to just 1 part of benzene per million parts of air. Industries that relied on benzene, including rubber manufacturing and oil refining, fought back. At a Labor Department hearing, Shell Oil presented the results of a study that seemed to contradict Peter's findings. After examining the deaths of some 36,000 of its workers and retirees, Shell found they, quote, did not have a greater risk from leukemia than the general population, end quote. The study was conducted by the company's medical director and the dean of the University of Texas School of Public Health. They recorded just 21 cases of leukemia among Shell workers and retirees. That wasn't much different from the expected number of 20.3 for the public overall.
I guess one could conclude from that study, well, there doesn't appear to be any adverse effect. So whatever's going on in petrochemical refineries, we don't need to change any practice that's happening there. You know, we don't need to, you know, have any education of workers. We don't need to lower any permissible exposure. That would be the implication of the results.
Peter didn't learn until many years later that the Shell report had been cleansed of crucial information that would have made benzene look far scarier. According to a draft obtained by a lawyer, an additional 22 Shell workers and retirees had died from various forms of lymphoma during the three-year study period. These cases would have made the cancer risk at Shell much higher than the general public's.
It just seems like this information was clearly being hidden from government regulators at the time they were trying to regulate a substance that's very dangerous in the workplace.
I reached out to Shell and the UT School of Public Health to see if anyone wanted to discuss the matter. No one did. A few months before that pivotal Labor Department hearing on benzene, Jimmy Carter had chosen a blunt, Kentucky-born scientist named Eula Bingham to lead OSHA. Bingham and her boss, Labor Secretary Ray Marshall, scared the living hell out of industry leaders who'd never taken OSHA seriously. Marshall announced on national TV that the agency would be going after, quote, whales, not minnows, end quote, meaning it would tackle the biggest workplace hazards and not bother with the minor ones. One of the whales was benzene. It was a departure from what Peter describes as standard OSHA policy.
What the agency will do is, you know, pick something that doesn't have a big economic impact and deal with that. That, in other words, go after the minnows rather than the whales.
Peter let Bingham know that he wanted to work for her. In 1978, he joined OSHA as director of its Office of Carcinogen Identification and Classification.
I mean, she was just amazing. She was a director that, in fact, was interested in occupational health. You know, a lot of these directors at OSHA, they've been like political appointees, and in fact, they felt their job was to stop regulation.
Under Bingham, OSHA issued a tough new benzene standard, but it was tied up in court for nearly a decade by the American Petroleum Institute. That delay likely cost countless workers their lives. Bingham tackled other hazards, too. She issued standards for cotton dust, which was killing textile workers, and for arsenic and lead. She also proposed something even more radical. She wanted to make it easier to regulate carcinogens in groups, as opposed to going chemical by chemical. Not surprisingly, many in industry hated that plan, and it never took effect. The consequences are still being felt today. There are workplace limits for fewer than 500 of the tens of thousands of chemicals currently on the market, and many of those limits are hopelessly out of date. Over the past half century, OSHA has managed to adopt or tighten standards on only about 30 chemicals. I interviewed Eula Bingham in 2014 when she was in her 80s and kept an office at the University of Cincinnati. She explained in her unfiltered way how Peter's Pliofilm studies had inspired her to press for a benzene standard. I said, "God damn it, we're going to have it," she told me. Peter had 3 good years under Bingham, but then Carter was ousted by Ronald Reagan. And in 1981, Bingham was replaced by a Florida construction company executive named Thorne Ochter. Almost immediately, Peter found himself in hot water for a letter he wrote to the International Agency for Research on Cancer. The letter focused on the dangers of formaldehyde, a chemical used in home insulation, pressed wood, resins, and other consumer products. Peter cited studies showing formaldehyde caused cancer in experimental animals. It's since been confirmed as a human carcinogen, by the way. A trade group called the Formaldehyde Institute pushed OSHA to fire Peter for insubordination. OSHA's Director of Health Standards, Bayless Walker, sent Peter a letter saying he was being removed from his job. But then, a young congressman and future vice president named Albert Gore Jr. stepped in and convened hearings. Here's Gore grilling Ochter.
It was on your advice that the letter proposing the firing of Dr. Infante was sent.
That is correct, that it was on my advice that the letter was sent.
Was it on your advice that the agency proposed to fire Dr. Infante?
No, sir.
Well, we just have a direct conflict in sworn testimony on the record. Dr. Bayless Walker, who testified a moment ago, said that he recommended to you that the letter not be sent.
Now, maybe it depends on your interpretation.
No, he said he didn't want to fire him and that he didn't recommend it, that he thought he shouldn't be fired.
I understand that's what he said here.
And that it was you that initiated that idea.
Mr. Chairman, yeah. I am as confused about this sort of course of events as you may be right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't feel confused.
Well,
Peter says the Reagan administration had a hit list of Carter people it wanted removed from the civil service. It was a scorched earth approach that should sound familiar to anyone paying attention to current events in Washington.
I think that it was pretty clear that the industry felt I was a thorn in their side because I was, you know, I would speak up about scientific data. As I told them many times, you know, I'm a doctor of public health. I'm an epidemiologist. I don't sacrifice my knowledge about epidemiology and about study results simply because I'm a government employee, and I'm going to maintain my right as a public health official to speak about the results of scientific studies and inform the public as I feel necessary. And so I continued to do that.
Somehow, Peter kept his job, but he spent three miserable years under Ochter, who believed overregulation was killing American enterprise. Reagan himself had vowed to do away with what he called burdensome, unnecessary regulations. By trying to protect public health, Peter was a roadblock to Reagan's pro-business agenda. This dark period was not without humor, though. One bizarre episode involved the chemical ethylene oxide, a vomiting dog, and Leonard Vance, who succeeded Bayless Walker as head of health standards at OSHA. It was so absurd that NPR did a segment on it.
Legislators in Capitol Hill have been trying to get OSHA to crack down on ethylene oxide. That's the gas used to sterilize hospital operating room equipment. About 100,000 hospital workers are exposed to this gas. Studies show they suffer three times as many miscarriages and higher rates of cancer compared to workers who are not exposed. Last year, OSHA seemed ready to issue tough new rules on ethylene oxide when suddenly R. Leonard Vance, director of health standards, told his staff to back off. A member of Vance's staff charged that Vance had blocked the new rules after meeting with a top executive from Union Carbide, which makes the chemical. At first, Vance denied it. Then he said, well, maybe he had met with the company executive, but it did not influence his decision. At which point, Representative George Miller, chairman of the Congressional Subcommittee, told Mr. Vance, we want to see all your office logs to see just whom you've been meeting and when. For weeks now, Miller and his staff have been engaged in delicate and difficult negotiations trying to get those logs.
Peter gets a kick out of explaining how Vance finally told the committee the logs were gone.
What he said was the logs, they were in the back of his pickup truck and he went hunting and his dogs got sick and barfed on the logs, and they were so disgusting he had to take them to the dump. And the only log that I guess he had left was one that, you know, wasn't related to that time and wasn't related to it. That was his alibi, I guess, for why he couldn't turn them over.
While all this was happening, Peter and his team at OSHA were working on new limits for ethylene oxide. One of those limits, for exposures over an 8-hour workday, became official right after the Vance incident. The other, for short-term exposures, was delayed several years. Toward the end of Ochter's tenure, Peter tussled with Shell again. This time, he accused the company of withholding data on worker blood abnormalities at its refinery in Wood River, Illinois. Shell insisted there was no such data. Peter knew that there was, thanks to a tip from a Wood River employee suffering from just such an abnormality. When Peter pressed the issue, Shell's industrial hygiene manager complained to Ochter. The manager said Peter was harassing Shell and it put an unnecessary strain on the company's relationship with OSHA. Again, Peter managed to hold on to his job. Ochter resigned under an ethical cloud not long after the Wood River incident, and Shell eventually produced the data it had said didn't exist. From the mid-1980s until his retirement in 2002, Peter had a mixed experience at OSHA. He helped push through a standard on hexavalent chromium. It's a virulent lung carcinogen that's used in dyes, paints, and other products. But he had to pressure agency leaders, some more than others, to keep moving on the worst occupational hazards. He fought with chemical manufacturers, oil companies, and Big Ag. He refused to be silenced. After Peter retired from OSHA, he became a consultant to plaintiffs in toxic exposure lawsuits, most of them involving benzene. He kept up with the evolving research, too. In 2016, he and other scientists sent a detailed memo to the International Agency for Research on Cancer. It's part of the World Health Organization. They wanted gasoline to be classified as a human carcinogen because of its benzene content. In March of this year, almost a decade later, the agency announced it had found sufficient evidence that exposure to gasoline causes acute myeloid leukemia and bladder cancer in adults. It found limited evidence that gasoline exposure causes certain childhood cancers. I called Peter to ask how he felt about the decision. He was pleased that his suspicions about gasoline had been validated. But of course, he wanted more.
He also, you know, should have concluded that gasoline causes myelodysplastic syndrome, which is a precursor to acute myelogenous leukemia. But it's a very positive thing from a public health standpoint, because the World Health Organization publishes documents that go out to all the countries in the world about causes of cancer. Maybe when people fill their gasoline tanks, they'll put the clip on and stand upwind rather than holding the pump right there at the filling hole in their car and just, you know, inhaling the gasoline vapor. That'll reduce their benzene exposure. You know, it'll reduce their risk of developing leukemias and lymphomas.
Something else happened to Peter in 2016, something not so positive. Shortly after Donald Trump was elected, Peter was booted from an EPA advisory panel on the weed killer glyphosate. It's a Bayer product that most of us know as Roundup. It's a suspected carcinogen. Peter had been evaluating the data on glyphosate, but he hadn't taken a position. Still, industry officials were worried, given his history of truth-telling, and given that EPA panels often influence agency rulemaking.
They wanted me removed because they thought, you know, I was biased against pesticides, which wasn't really true because I had been on an EPA advisory panel the year before on a pesticide, and no one complained about me being biased on that.
Today, deep into the second Trump administration, things are appreciably worse for any contemporary version of Peter Infante, should such a person even exist. Advisory panels and regulations have been dismantled. Agencies have been gutted. Scientists are no longer admired or listened to. Over time, the public will feel the effects of these shifts, because some of the same chemicals Peter fought to control in the workplace continue to compromise people's health. Last year, for example, researchers at Johns Hopkins University detected very high levels of ethylene oxide in some parts of Louisiana. That's the chemical that was at the center of the dog vomit incident. Some of their readings showed levels 1,000 times higher than what the EPA considers safe. Peter Infante is an anachronism. When he worked for the government, he prioritized public health over corporate profits.
Over my whole life, I've never had secrets from the public. I think people are less frightened when they have confidence in what you're saying than when they find out later that there's some hazard that you didn't tell them about.
Peter is 84 years old now. He still believes in the power of scientific fact and the clear communication of risk. In other words, he still believes in the power of truth.
This bonus episode of Fumed is a production of Public Health Watch. It was written, reported, and hosted by the executive director and editor-in-chief of Public Health Watch, Jim Morris. Executive producer and editor was Susan White. Senior producer was Selena Arredondo. Additional help from Savannah Strott, Jordan Gosporé, and me, David Leffler. Our theme song was composed by Michael Ramos. Other music by Epidemic Sound. Sound engineering by Mark Bush. Artwork by Matthew Fleming. Special thanks to our distribution partner, Texas Public Radio, and to the Texas Tribune for studio and technical support. To learn more about our work and this podcast, visit fumedpodcast.com.